Kalorama, a Recorded Books Highbridge imprint, presents The Centrist Solution, How We Made Government Work and Can Make It Work Again, by Senator Joseph I. Lieberman. Read by Rich Miller. Introduction. The Nightmares of John Adams. There is nothing I dread so much as a division of the Republic into two great parties, each arranged under its leader, and concerting measures in opposition to each other. This, in my humble apprehension, is to be dreaded as the greatest political evil under our Constitution. John Adams, Second President of the United States. For the last few decades, the American people have been living through what John Adams considered the greatest political evil under our Constitution, and our country has suffered greatly. In this dreaded nightmare, we have become more divided. Our largest problems remain unsolved, and our international leadership has been compromised. For the future of our country and our children, we must find a way to do better. I have written this book with the goal of helping our leaders and the people who elect them find that better way. Within this book, I will share stories that illustrate what I learned during 40 years in elective office, 24 in the U.S. Senate, about how to make America's government work. This book is a call for the restoration of bipartisanship and centrism to Washington. When put into practice, those methods have always enabled our democracy to function best. Centrism is not an ideology like liberalism, conservatism, socialism, or fascism. It is a strategy for how to govern in a democracy. It is the bringing together of people from different parties and ideologies to genuinely listen to each other, so they can negotiate compromises and get things done for their constituents and country. The ideologies and priorities of the Republican and Democratic parties have naturally changed over the course of American history, but the need for bipartisanship and centrism to bring them together has not. It remains the best, often the only, way for democratic governments to produce results. Centrism is not the same as moderation. However, being a moderate makes it easier to find the way to the center, because most moderates are already there on matters of policy. Centrism is anathema to extremists of the left and right, because getting together in the center requires that they compromise, which they abhor. They don't understand that the compromises required in the problem-solving center are not compromises of principle, morality, or ethics. As I learned in my 10 years in the state Senate and 24 in the U.S. Senate, the big choices are not between right and wrong. They are between solving problems or having another futile political fight. Between demanding 100% of what you want or engaging in some give and take with the other party to actually get something done. Here is a simplistic illustration of my point in the area of economic policy. The far right argues for pure free market capitalism with no governmental involvement. The far left argues that the government itself should control most of the economy. Center left and center right leaders avoid those extremes and find a common ground that preserves private property ownership and free markets, but regulates them to protect the public interest. Centrists understand these words from the Talmud. Without governments, people would treat each other like fish. The big ones would eat the little ones. But centrists also remember Winston Churchill's wisdom. Some regard private enterprise as if it were a predatory tiger to be shot. Others look upon it as a cow they can milk. A handful see it for what it really is, the strong horse that pulls the whole cart. It's no coincidence that I chose private enterprise and a quotation from Winston Churchill in my illustration of centrism. One is a hallmark of democratic nations, and the other is a man who spent a lifetime in government service under a parliamentary democracy. Both were bulwarks against dictatorships. Centrism is irrelevant in a dictatorship, because the dictator stifles all differences of opinion. But in a democracy, centrism is essential. Why? Because in democracies, the perpetual challenge is to form a majority from the multitude of parties, factions, and opinions that freedom of speech, assembly, religion, conscience, and more, makes possible. It's valuable to look back at American history, which shows how important centrism has been to our national journey, beginning with the critical compromises that allowed our founders to reach agreement at the Constitutional Convention to form our government and protect our independence. I will do that in Chapter 1. As I look back on my 2+ decades in the U.S. Senate, all of the important legislation I helped enact began and ended in the bipartisan center. I will describe the legislative products I am most proud of later. They span a wide spectrum of policy, including the Clean Air Act of 1990, the legislative campaign to support American military action to stop post-Cold War aggression and genocide in the Balkans, the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, and the reform of America's intelligence agencies after the terrorist attacks of 9/11-2001. The Balanced Budget Act of 1997, made possible by the odd couple centrist partnership of President Bill Clinton and Speaker of the House of Representatives Newt Gingrich, and the repeal of the anti-gay Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy in our military, which I co-sponsored with my Republican colleague, Senator Susan Collins of Maine. My centrism also helped give me some of the most unexpected political opportunities of my career, such as being asked by Al Gore to be his vice presidential running mate on the Democratic ticket in 2000, then 8 years later being vetted by John McCain to be his running mate on the Republican ticket. Bipartisanship and centrism also caused a lot of political controversy and upheaval in my career, and that's another part of the story I want to tell. For example, my position on one issue during the George W. Bush administration, my opposition to Democratic demands that the president withdraw American troops from Iraq, led to a Democratic primary against me in 2006. I lost, but was re-elected as an independent. America's freedom, security, and prosperity depend on a healthy political center, a center that avoids chaotic and self-destructive extremes, and instead produces progress and stability. On public opinion poll after public opinion poll, the American people show they understand these truths. Large majorities say they prefer elected officials who are willing to compromise with the other party to solve problems, rather than sticking absolutely to policy positions they have endorsed in their campaigns. And yet, the representatives who the voters elect to lead them in Congress and the White House seem more frequently to avoid the center like it was a hot zone of infectious disease. After the presidential election of 2020, Mark Penn, chairman of the Harris Poll, which is among the oldest and most prestigious trackers of American opinion and social sentiment, wrote, "We are one country divided by two parties. America remains primarily a moderate centrist country in which, as Penn explains, most voters prefer compromise on health care, immigration, and other thorny issues that the extremes of the parties have pushed to the limits." As the Harris exit polls show, the election of Joe Biden as our 46th president was, in good measure, a victory of centrists over the partisan and ideological extremes. Almost all self-identified liberals, 23% of all voters, voted for Biden, and almost all conservatives, 38% of all voters, voted for Trump. It was the moderates, the centrists, also 38% of all voters, who made the difference. In 2016, Hillary Clinton carried self-identified moderate voters by 12 points, but in 2020, Biden carried them by 30 points, an enormous 18% increase that helped decide the election. In some very encouraging ways, the 2020 election can be seen as a centrist uprising against partisan and ideological divisions, harsh personal rhetoric, and the resulting governmental gridlock in Washington. It is also true, however, that President Trump ran way ahead of the predictions of most pollsters in 2020, receiving more than 74 million votes, and in 15 battleground states, actually running more than 1 million votes ahead of Biden. Many Republican candidates for Congress and state offices who are loyal to Trump did even better. They got elected. In fact, the number of Republicans and Democrats who took the Senate or House oath of office to serve in January 2021 was almost even. It also seems clear that President Trump intends to remain the leader of the Republican Party at least until 2024, which will definitely work against it becoming more centrist. In sum, there is compelling evidence from the 2020 election, in spite of the polling and Joe Biden's centrist election, that shows there is still a big partisan divide in our country. As Mark Penn said, we are one country divided by two parties. There is a lot of work to do before bipartisan centrism is back conclusively in American politics. President Biden has said he is a proud Democrat, but intends to be the president of all Americans, working across party lines in Washington, and hoping thereby to unify the rest of our country. I know from serving in the U.S. Senate with Joe Biden for 24 years that he means what he says. It's what he regularly did in the Senate, and it helped him build an impressive record of legislative accomplishments. Now, President Biden and members of both parties in Congress have to find their way to the center to listen to each other respectfully, negotiate thoughtfully, and compromise productively. It's the only way we will solve some of our serious national problems and seize some of our great national opportunities. It will require Republican members of Congress to break away from Trump, and it will require Biden and Democratic members of Congress to declare their independence from far-left Democrats who won't compromise. I hope the stories in this book and the lessons I draw from the bipartisan successes in which I was privileged to participate during my senatorial career will be helpful to Republican and Democratic elected officials who are fed up with the political dysfunction that has crippled our government and diminished our great country. I know the overwhelming majority of them want to make our government work better again. Bipartisan centrism is the way. That's the pivotal lesson I learned. And so, for all who follow in elective office, I aim to illustrate and emphasize how effective and beneficial our government has been when the voters have received the bipartisan problem-solving they want. I also will offer suggestions about how to close the gap between the dysfunctional and divisive government the American people have endured and the problem-solving, opportunity-creating government they deserve. In the last chapter, I will describe my work with an organization called No Labels, which I have supported since it was founded in 2010. My Senate Chief of Staff, Clarine Nardi Riddle, was one of its five official founders. When I left the Senate in 2013, I became personally active in No Labels, and since 2014 have been its national chair. Today, I believe No Labels has done more than any other political organization to bring America's government back to the bipartisan, problem-solving center. It is one of our best hopes for a brighter American future. 1. The Roots of American Centrism. America's founders were educated in the Greek classics, Judeo-Christian theology, and the philosophy of the Enlightenment, all of which guided their creation of a centrist government. In Greek philosophy, Aristotle held that the middle way between extremes was the best way. Harmony that moderated extremes was the goal. Courage is a favorite example of Aristotle's centrism. Courage is a human virtue, he said, but if taken too far to one side, becomes reckless and dangerous. If it slides too far to the other side, it becomes cowardice, which is also dangerous. The center point of courage, between the cowardly and reckless, is the place to be. Aristotle's lesson is memorably illustrated in Greek mythology. Daedalus builds wax and feather wings for himself and his son Icarus so they can escape the control of King Minos by air. Daedalus instructs Icarus to fly the middle course, between the heat of the sun and the cool of the ocean. But Icarus is infatuated by his ability to fly, and goes higher and higher, closer and closer to the sun, until the wax on his wings melts, the wings separate from his body, and he falls into the sea and drowns. That was a large price to pay for leaving the centrist course. America's founders were well educated in Greek philosophy and mythology, but it was Judeo-Christian theology that influenced them more. There, they also found great value placed on the center path. In the Talmud, Rabbi Judah offers a parable that reads like Daedalus. There is a highway that runs between two paths, one of fire and the other of snow. If a person walks too close to the fire, this person will be scorched by the flames. If too close to the snow, this person will be bitten by the cold. What is the person to do? This person is to walk in the middle, taking care not to be scorched by the heat nor bitten by the cold. Maimonides, the 12th century Spanish Jewish philosopher and scholar, wrote, "The right way is the mean, namely that disposition that is equally distant from the two extremes in its class." Christian texts are full of appeals for personal and societal moderation as the natural result of living Christian values. Evil consists in discordance from their rule or measure. This may happen by exceeding the measure or falling short of it. Therefore, it is evident that moral virtue observes the mean. St. Thomas Aquinas. "Let your moderation be known unto all men, because the Lord is at hand." Philippians chapter 4, verse 5. "All things are lawful unto me, but all things are not expedient. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be brought under the power of any." 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 12. Many leaders among the founding American generation brought to our nation's shores a belief in the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. The theologian who most influenced them was John Calvin. "There is no kind of government more salutary," Calvin wrote, "than one in which liberty is properly exercised with becoming moderation and properly constituted on a durable basis." Calvin's Protestant Reform theology can be described as centrist, sitting as it does between the extremes of Anabaptist liberalism and Catholic legalism. Although Calvin was a theologian and religious leader, he had strong political views, centrist political views, based on his wonderful phrase, "becoming moderation." "The purpose of political government and law," Calvin said, "is to cultivate civil restraint and righteousness in people, and to promote general peace and liberty." Michael Novak, the Roman Catholic theologian, wrote that the American eagle took flight in the 18th century with two wings. One was the Calvinist faith of the founders, particularly their knowledge and love of the Bible, and the other was the philosophy of the Enlightenment. Our forefathers were very much aware of the Enlightenment's great European philosophers, including Montesquieu, Voltaire, Rousseau, Hume, Locke, and Bacon. Those great thinkers believed in the primacy of reason and embraced the scientific method of their time. Tolerance, particularly religious tolerance, was very important to them. They advocated for a government that upheld civic virtue and protected freedom of religion and speech, as well as individual equality and opportunity. The operative political strategy of the Enlightenment was centrist. In his Spirit of the Law, Montesquieu writes that the essence of his political philosophy is the spirit of moderation. Voltaire's guiding philosophy for government, meanwhile, was one that has been repeated by political centrists since he wrote it in the 18th century. "The perfect is the enemy of good." In other words, the compromises that centrist politics require are the best way to solve society's problems and bring about progress. If you accept only perfection, you will not solve or build anything. Voltaire's pithy statement is not only a wise comment on the general imperfection of the human race, but also an inescapable fact about the impossibility of achieving perfection in the work of political leaders who must find common ground to produce results. The great values of faith and enlightenment motivated and directed our founders as they drafted America's Declaration of Independence in 1776 and our Constitution in 1787. In the case of the Constitution, there were large and fundamental differences of opinion about America's future government that needed to be reconciled. Compromises were therefore imperative to achieve the unity America needed to secure its independence from England. However, there were no disagreements about our founders' purpose in adopting the Declaration of Independence at the Continental Congress at the State House in Philadelphia in the summer of 1776. The resolution for independence from England passed unanimously. Differences of opinion arose around the actual words the delegates chose to explain their declaration, and those choices have greatly influenced American history since. The Declaration preceded the Revolutionary War. America's values were therefore declared before its boundaries were secured, meaning the words chosen for the Declaration were important. They emerged from admirable discussion, negotiation, and compromise among the delegates to the convention. The most important phrases of the 1,337-word Declaration constitute some of the most important words ever written in the English language. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To make clear how determinative those sentences are, the Declaration immediately goes on to say, "To secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the government." In other words, the new nation was being established for the primary purpose of implementing the Universal Declaration of Human Rights made in the first paragraph. But there was not unanimous support for the words Thomas Jefferson proposed for that pivotal paragraph from the outset. The original language he sent to the other four members of the drafting committee of five, John Adams of Massachusetts, Benjamin Franklin of Pennsylvania, Robert Livingston of New York, and, may I say with some parochial pride, Roger Sherman of Connecticut, was, "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable." Franklin asked that the words "sacred and undeniable" be replaced by "self-evident." Why? Walter Isaacson, a great Franklin biographer, believes Franklin was reflecting the philosophy of the Enlightenment, particularly as he had learned it from David Hume, the philosopher with whom he had become friendly during the years he was in London. Franklin wanted the new nation to be founded on rationality, not religion. Everyone, including Jefferson, looked up to Franklin, who was much older and more worldly than the other delegates in Philadelphia. Jefferson himself was 37 years younger than Franklin. The committee accepted Franklin's edit, but John Adams was not satisfied with the result. He wanted to add words that reflected the other wing of Michael Novak's American Eagle, Calvinist Christianity. He asked that the committee add the sentence, "They are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights." In the spirit of compromise, Jefferson and the drafting committee, and ultimately the Continental Congress, accepted the amendments that both Franklin and Adams offered, resulting in the timeless words of the Declaration that have defined our national purpose and shaped our history since then. That was not the only compromise in the drafting of the Declaration of Independence. Take, for example, the section listing the misdeeds of the British Crown that justified the Americans' claim to independence. Jefferson originally included the charge that Britain had forced slavery on the colonies. The drafting committee accepted that wording. When it came before the full Congress, however, some of the delegates argued that this language went too far and would offend people in Britain who might otherwise support the American Revolution. In the interest of moderation, pragmatism, and unity, that charge against Britain was removed from the Declaration. As significant as these compromises were in leading to unanimous adoption of the Declaration of Independence, they were modest compared to the great differences that had to be bridged to reach agreement at the Constitutional Convention 11 years later. When the delegates left their home states for Philadelphia in May of 1787, there wasn't even unanimous consent about the purpose of the convention. A majority agreed that the Articles of Confederation were not working well, primarily because the states had too much power and the national government too little. But most of the delegates saw the convention only as an opportunity to modify the articles to achieve a bit more authority at the center of the U.S. government. A few delegates had larger goals. They wanted to abandon the articles and write a new constitution for a new, stronger national government. Alexander Hamilton of New York and James Madison of Virginia united in making this case in the Federalist Papers. With the support of the hero of the American Revolution, General George Washington, they ultimately prevailed. But it wasn't easy, and it required more than the force of the Federalist Papers' reasoned arguments and Washington's stature. It required hard, practical compromises to protect and strengthen their experiment in independent self-government. The states were, after all, very different from one another. There were large and small population states, and slave and free states. They had different ideas about how much power they should give the citizenry in the republic they were creating, and how much authority should be added to the new national government and taken from the state governments. Like all compromises, the great ones reached in Philadelphia at the Constitutional Convention were not perfect. Remember Voltaire's warning that the quest for perfection cannot be allowed to block the achievement of good results. In the end, the delegates wrote a constitution and strengthened America in a way that has sustained and guided our nation since. In fact, it changed the vision of government throughout the world. And it only happened because the delegates in Philadelphia came to the center and made difficult, imperfect compromises. First, most of the delegates ultimately accepted that it was necessary to write a new constitution for a new government, but they still had to work out their differences about its form and content, or they would not have the votes necessary to adopt a constitution and send it back to the states for ratification. When it came to the new national legislative body, there was a consensus that it should have two chambers. That was what the delegates were familiar with from Britain, and had adopted in all of the states except Pennsylvania, which had a unicameral legislature. But how would they apportion representatives from the states to the new Congress? And how would they select the representatives? Those were very divisive questions. Large population states were pitted against small ones, slave states against free ones. The large population states naturally wanted representation in both chambers of Congress to be based on population. They were led by Virginia, which, together with Massachusetts and Pennsylvania, contained almost half of the young country's population. But the small population states at the convention, led by New Jersey, were larger in number, and they wanted each state to have equal representation in both chambers of Congress. Without their support, no constitution would be adopted at the convention. This dispute threatened to break up the convention and effectively end the American experiment. The delegates were gridlocked during the summer of 1787. The breakthrough came when the Connecticut delegation, led by Roger Sherman and Oliver Ellsworth, proposed what became known as the Connecticut Compromise. It was sensible and simple. Representation in the House would reflect the population of the states, but in the Senate, each state would have equal representation regardless of its population. Would enslaved Americans, who constituted 40% of the population of the southern states at that time, be counted in the apportionment of seats in the House? The southerners wanted the slaves to be counted, but, of course, not to be freed. Many of the northerners argued that if black slaves were to be counted, they should be liberated. James Wilson of Pennsylvania, appreciating that the larger population states like his, Massachusetts and Virginia, needed the support of some of the southern states to adopt a system of representation based on population, proposed that seats in the House be based on the free population plus 3/5 of the slave population. This dehumanizing compromise not only left slavery in America untouched, but gave the southern states about a dozen more seats in the Congress and a dozen more votes in the Electoral College. 9 states supported the 3/5 compromise. Only New Jersey and Delaware voted against it. The anti-slavery forces were upset by the 3/5 compromise and pressed for a ban in the Constitution on international slave trading into the U.S. In other words, although the Constitution would not alter the status of the current slave population, they wanted to legislate an end to the importation of more slaves. The southern states opposed that, and another compromise was reached. International slave trading would be banned in America, but not until 20 years later, at the earliest, in 1808. There were also various proposals for how to elect members of Congress, many of them not really democratic. Hamilton proposed that the House...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?